here to visit once again a case that has been pending and returned to us and held by us and been back and forth several times. But the case today is Click2Call Technologies v. Oracle Corporation, case number 151242. As I understand it, Mr. Ayers, you want 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and you all are going to split the argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, and the government's going to go last, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, you may begin.
Judge O'Malley, may it please the court, Peter Ayers on behalf of the appellant Click2Call, and despite the length of time it took to get here, we're grateful to be here before this court today. Your Honors, the board erred as a matter of law in this case by elevating a broad legal fiction over the clear intent of Congress. The board's interpretation of Section 315B in this case conflicts with the plain meaning of the statute, is contrary to the legislative history, and is inconsistent with the PTO's own regulations. As a result, the board's decision is due no deference, and this court should reverse. I want to turn first to the language of the statute, as we must, and make 3 points. The first is that 315B is clear and unequivocal. It says, in a narrow class of cases, an IPR, quote, may not be instituted. And as this court said in Wi-Fi 1 versus Broadcom, 315B is a fundamental limit on the agency's authority to act. It's not some minor statutory technicality. Two, the statute is also unambiguous, and no party is arguing otherwise. It's unambiguous both as to the cause and to the effect. Again, as this court said, or I guess it was Judge O'Malley in your concurring opinion in Wi-Fi 1, 315B uses an unambiguous phrase, an IPR may not be instituted if. There's also no ambiguity about what is the trigger, what triggers that consequence, and that is service in this case. And there's no factual dispute that service was properly affected in this case. Third,
how do you respond to your friend's arguments on the other side that there is a parade of horribles that might occur if we don't contemplate exceptions to what you say is otherwise unambiguous language?
Worst case, litigation or invalidity is litigated in the district court as it has been for over 100 years. That's the worst case scenario if Oracle is not permitted to go forward with an IPR. It's not, the sky is not falling in that case, Your Honor.
And with that case, with your district court case dismissed, would that there be any DJ action that they could bring at that point, or is there really any threat?
Well, there's actually a case pending that's been stayed, so that case would just move forward. And in fact, it's going to move forward regardless because there are claims that were not invalidated by the board in this case. So that case is being stayed pending the outcome of this appeal. So that case is going to move forward, and invalidity is going to be litigated in the district court regardless of the outcome in this case. So there's certainly not a parade of horribles if this court reverses the IPR.
Well,
and I do, I'm sorry.
Even if it's not horrible per yes. se for invalidity to be contested in the district court, the statute allows for an IPR.
Yes.
So the horrible here would be that you could manipulate things in a way as to lull an accused infringer into thinking that they don't have to worry about challenging your patent ever because you just withdrew, you dismissed without prejudice your complaint, and thereby you're effectively eliminating a statutory right they otherwise have. Why isn't that horrible?
Well, because, frankly, that's the statute that Congress enacted. That 315B protects patent owners. That's what is clear. It's not meant to protect accused infringers. If you look at both 315A and 315B, it says an inter partes review may not be instituted, and then it puts the burden on the petitioner in both cases, both in A, where they take an affirmative act, and in B, where they're put on notice of it. And the fact that they either can't, as in this case, it is sort of a odd situation given the timing, or filed a declaratory judgment action that they're time barred from filing an IPR. Again, we don't see that as a as a huge loss in the grand scheme of things. This is the one protection, procedural protection, that patent owners were afforded in the AIA.
And there's no dispute, right, that 315B applies even to cases in which the earlier action was 12 years ago, long before IPRs existed.
No, in fact, the board has a case right on point. I'm sure the solicitor will back me up on this, where a party made an argument, a statutory argument, that based on the word is served, they argue that that requires service to be affected after post-AIA, and the board rejected that. I'm sorry, I don't have the citation for you.
One kind of gamesmanship worry has been that a patent owner could file an action, use the, what is it, 41A1, dismiss it quickly.
Sure.
In the context in which no agreement or court approval is required, the clock starts running and the other side doesn't really know whether it's worthwhile to go file an IPR. I think that's the gamesmanship situation.
I understand.
The one like this case and like other cases,
sure,
where there's,
sure,
a voluntary dismissal, yeah, without prejudice with agreement, obviously,
right,
both the court and the other side have substantial control over that, and they can kind of take care of that. And they can also take care of situations where they ask, will you please give us a covenant not to sue? And you say no, and then they know, oh, something might actually be up.
We understand that there's no end to the amount of creative lawyering that can take place. And we certainly are sensitive to gamesmanship in that case. Frankly, again, you look at what happened in the other board's precedential opinion in the LG case, where there was a complaint that was filed. It was dismissed with prejudice as to existing products, but dismissed without prejudice as with respect to future products. And the board in that case held that it triggered 315B and an IPR could not be instituted, even though the patent owner turned around and then sued the defendant again on its future products.
Can I ask you this, getting away for a minute from the kind of practical consequences,
certainly,
whether
are.
There are horribles, whether there's gamesmanship, and
yes,
so on. The central legal contention, mm-hmm, I gather, is not so much that there's ambiguity in the text, but that there's a background tradition of treating involuntary dismissals without prejudice as erasing the action.
Yes.
Why do you think that that background principle is either inapplicable here or in any event shouldn't lead to the board's and director's conclusion?
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, the statute provides an explicit exception to 315B time limit. That is a joinder. So Congress provided a mechanism for parties who were time barred to have their IPR heard, albeit only when there's another IPR that has been instituted. So I think that Congress clearly knew how to provide for exceptions to 315B when it wanted to, and it didn't provide for the one in this case where there was a dismissal without prejudice. That's the first thing. Secondly, there are a number of other legal consequences that flow from filing and service, regardless of whether or not the case is dismissed with prejudice. And we've cited several. Rule 11 is an example. We contend, willfulness, indirect infringement, the knowledge requirement that would accrue having been served with a complaint, that there are legal consequences that flow from being served with a complaint. But perhaps the best example of that is actually hidden in plain sight in Bonneville itself. We've been focused on actually the second appeal in Bonneville, which is the second appeal from the Board of Contract Appeals, but there was actually a first appeal in that case, an appeal from the Court of Federal Claims. And what happened in that case is that the Court of Federal Claims dismissed the complaint, the contractor's complaint under the, I don't know if it's the Tucker Act or whatnot, because it had filed the earlier appeal to the Board of Contract Appeals, and the Contracts Disputes Act contains an election, that a binding election that the contractor must make. Either he can either choose to go to the Board of Contract Appeals or to the Court of Federal Claims. And once they make that election, it's binding, even if that earlier case is dismissed without prejudice. And we would cite, and I apologize that this was not developed in the briefs, but they're actually cite the court to Bonneville versus United States, 43 F3rd 649, Fed Sur 1994. That's the first appeal in Bonneville. And then there are two lower court opinions, Sinernet versus United States, 41 Fed Claim 375, Court of Federal Claims 1998, and Mark Smith Construction versus United States, 10 Claims Court 540, Claims Court 1986. We think that's actually the better analogy in this case, given 315A, which has the exact same election, albeit either to the district court or to the PTAB. And
so
yet,
just so I understand, yes, what you're relying on is that the Court of Federal Claims suit was nixed because of the earlier board suit, even though the board suit had been voluntarily dismissed.
Exactly.
Without prejudice.
Exactly.
Without prejudice.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's Bonneville, and we've been focused on the second appeal, and it didn't dawn on me until I got into Bonneville more carefully. And as I said, I think that the analogy is a good one, because 315A includes the same election doctrine. And yet, despite that, the board also invokes this same legal fiction in those 315A cases to allow a petitioner or allow for an IPR to be instituted, even if that declaratory judgment action is dismissed without prejudice, because it treats it as if it never occurred, just as it did in this case. And we think
if we were to agree with you on these points, what do we do then? Because I think initially, and admittedly this case has been around a while, initially you said we should remand. Now I think you say we shouldn't. What do we do?
I think that this, given the unique circumstances in this case, that this court can and should reverse, that it can address Oracle's alternative grounds. I think that's a clear, you know, legal question about what effect does the re-examination statute have on 315, if any. And we think that privity is a red herring in light of the fact that a barred party was named as a real party in interest in the petition. And despite Oracle's arguments that 315B is analyzed on a petition by petition basis, not a petitioner by petitioner basis.
You cited the Terramark decision, I think, from a PTAB.
Yes.
They talk about each petitioner is bound by the other if there's evidence of substantial control being exerted by the barred petitioner on the petition. Do we have that evidence here that Ingenio exerted substantial control?
That is the proper analysis if you're looking at whether or not that party is time barred. In this case, Your Honor, it's we don't need to get into the privity relationship between the parties, because a barred party filed a petition, and I want to draw the court's attention to what the statute says, and more importantly, the regulation. The statute says an inter partes review may not be instituted if the petition requesting the IPR is filed more than a year after. So again, we think it's decided on a petition by petition basis.
That's at least the position that the PTAB took in connection with CBM proceedings, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And we, as I described, I think that given the parallelism between 315A and 315B, those two should be treated the same. But I wanted to turn the court's attention to Rule 42.101, which is basically the board's verbatim rule that corresponds to 315B. It says a person may file a petition unless the petition requesting the proceeding is filed more than 1 year. So again, 315B is decided on a petition by petition basis, not a petitioner by petitioner. Oracle wants to argue that, I don't know, you can look at each petitioner in isolation. No, you can't do that under the statute.
If they had simply filed four pieces of paper instead of one, the patent would be invalid.
It depends. Then there might be a factual question about if they were acting on behalf of the other party or if there was some control by a time-barred party. That's where you get into the whole real party in interest analysis. We don't need to go there, but it's not true that Oracle necessarily could have filed on its own behalf. That's the RPX situation where Apple goes out and hires a third party to do its bidding for them. Okay? And it's quite possible. We would need discovery in that case that Oracle could have been doing Ingenio's bidding for them in them, even if Ingenio wasn't named on the petition. So, but we don't think the court needs to go there.
All right, you're out of time. I'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Stanley Panikowski on behalf of Oracle and the other appellees. The merits of the board's substantive decision invalidating the 836 patent are uncontested. So the only issue is section 315B. And on the dismissal without prejudice issue, that is the basis of the board's decision, apart from our alternative grounds, the fundamental flaw in CTC's argument was stated at the beginning of counsel's presentation today. Counsel for CTC said that the board elevated a broad legal fiction over the clear intent of Congress. However, Your Honor, under this court's and the Supreme Court's precedent, in cases like Cannon versus the University of Chicago, Morgan v. Principi, Bond versus United States.
But didn't the Supreme Court very recently say that, in fact, a dismissal without prejudice does not mean that the case never existed and that a dismissal without a defendant can still be a prevailing party even when the action is dismissed without prejudice?
Your Honor, there are circumstances like that where you may have certain collateral consequences from what happened during a lawsuit, even though it was dismissed without prejudice. However, here, Your Honor, we're not talking about collateral consequences like attorney's fees or sanctions. Rather, we're talking, Your Honor, about something that was very integral to the act of filing the lawsuit itself. We know from the Advisory Committee's Note 3 to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4 that serving the complaint is part and parcel of bringing the action. It immediately follows upon filing it. And a case...
But you're asking us to read words into the statute. You're asking us to say that the statute says that it runs from when a party is served with a complaint, unless that complaint is later dismissed. But it doesn't say that in the statute.
Your Honor, you are correct. It does not expressly say that. However, we are not asking the court to read words into the statute. Rather, what we are asking the court to do is what the Supreme Court and this court have done repeatedly, including as recently as Aqua Products v. Mittal, which is to read the statutory language against the backdrop of a broad, general, and fundamental legal principle that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice leaves the action as if it had never been brought.
But as you just referred to fees, perhaps willfulness, which I think at least, I don't remember whether you agree with that, but I think the director does. It's not as if the action was never brought for all purposes. It is for some. So why for these?
You are correct that it is for some purposes. And in fact, every case that CTC cited at pages 30 and 31 of its reply brief that gives an example like fees or sanctions where there can be some collateral consequences starts with the broad proposition that the dismissal with prejudice means that the action had never been brought. And one of the examples of
a
situation...
No, don't both usually start with the broad proposition that a dismissal without prejudice is not a merits determination. It doesn't start with the broad proposition that these two cases that you rely upon seem to say. It doesn't say the broad proposition of law is that the action was never brought.
Your Honor, yes, that is the broad proposition of law that this court articulated in Bonneville and Graves.
Just those, but all those other cases you're talking about, the broad proposition that they start with is that normally a dismissal with prejudice is not considered a dismissal on the merits. And then they say, but that doesn't matter for a variety of circumstances. But they never say that we believe there is this fiction that the action never existed.
Your Honor, there is more to the proposition than just the notion that it's not a disposition on the merits. For example, the Seventh Circuit and Eighth Circuit cases that this court cited in Bonneville are applying this broad legal principle in other contexts. And tying this to Judge Toronto's question about what are the some purposes for which the action is treated as it's never been brought, one of the most prominent examples is the very situation we have here today, and that is a statute of limitations. We had that in Bonneville, in Graves, and also in one of the cases cited in CTC's supplemental brief at page 8, the Seventh Circuit's decision in Elmore v. Henderson, the court said, a suit dismissed without prejudice is treated for statute of limitations purposes as if it had never been filed.
If I remember right, lots and lots of the cases are statute of limitations cases, but none of them work in the way that this does. They all say that if you bring an action that has to be within 3 years and you voluntarily dismiss it, then the clock has not in fact stopped running. And when you later bring an action and say, well, here I am, the question is it timely? And that question is answered by asking whether the later filing was timely.
You disregard
the first one. That would be as if the counterpart to that here would be the filing of a timely IPR petition, voluntarily dismissed, followed by a untimely IPR petition. We have a question about whether an action that starts a clock is to be disregarded as in fact not really starting it.
Your Honor, you are correct that this situation appears to be unique relative to the other cases cited in that it involves the act of service triggering a limitations period. And there are two reasons, Your Honor, why the dismissal without prejudice still has the same legal effect here. One is the breadth of the legal principle, as articulated, cited, and applied in cases like Bonneville and Graves. And the second reason, Your Honor, is because the act that triggers the running of the limitations period is not simply general notice, but is rather service. An official act that is integral to the bringing of the action, in fact, a case that CTC itself cited at page 18 of its reply brief, Murphy Brothers from the Supreme Court, says that service of process is the official trigger for responsive action. And that, Your Honor, is why it's more appropriate to treat service for purposes of triggering the statute of limitations like these other statute of limitations situations for purposes of whether the action ever existed than it is to treat it like all these other cases where courts have said, even if you dismiss without prejudice, it doesn't get you off the hook for your frivolous arguments. It doesn't keep you out of jail for throwing a pie in your adversary's face. I think that because this statute talks about a legal consequence of a legal act of service integral to filing, it falls on the same side of the line as Bonneville and Graves. And that is why, Your Honors, Congress did not need to specifically say that service triggers a statute of limitations except when there's a dismissal without prejudice. That is the nature of a presumption, Your Honors. If Congress wanted to overcome that broad fundamental presumption, it would have needed to say that that presumption does not apply. And that is why, Your Honor, this is not a situation where congressional silence simply means silence. We're not standing here saying that, well, in the event that the complaint is served after the second full moon of a month, we don't know what Congress thinks about the situation. What happens if the complaint was served in a year when the Cubs won the World Series? We don't know what Congress was thinking. Those are all situations where silence equals silence because there is no background presumption relating to those matters. Here, however, when you're talking about service of the complaint triggering a limitations period, there is a background presumption that governs that situation. a voluntary dismissal without prejudice.
Even in Shaw, we didn't have to directly address this issue, but we said, how could it be that you would ever nullify the act of service when the act of service is the triggering event in the statute?
Your Honor, the legal effects of the act of service can be nullified in the exact same way that the legal effects of a filing of a complaint or a notice of appeal are nullified when it is dismissed without prejudice. No one is saying, Your Honor, that whether it's filing or service, that you are literally rewinding history and acting as if no one had ever engaged in the physical act.
But to use your language, the Bonneville and many similar cases involve nullifying certain legal effects.
Yes, Your Honor.
Certain legal effects, like the obligation to continue, if you're on the other side of a case, in the case initiated when the case goes away by voluntary dismissal, the legal effect of satisfying the statute of limitations, that's nullified. But it's particular legal effects, and I guess I have not seen a case that said the legal effect, even of the voluntary dismissal of a complaint, if one legal consequence of the complaint by some statute had been a statute of limitations starts running for another unrelated case, I'm not sure where the background principle is for that.
Your Honor, I'm about to cut into the Patent Office's time. May I?
I'll give you two more minutes since I'm giving him some rebuttal back.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honor, in addition to the integral legal nature of service relative to the filing of a complaint, the reason why we don't have cases dealing with precisely this situation in either direction is because this is an unusual statute. Perhaps it is unique in that you do have, one, the act of service, and then, two, it is triggering a limitations period. And we're talking about whether the limitations period is triggered rather than told. Despite the unusual nature of the statute, the background presumption is the same and has its ordinary operation. And part of the reason, Your Honor...
Do you think that background presumption applies with respect to all three kinds of 41A dismissals? I mean, there are lots of different types of dismissals under Rule 41. Do you differentiate between them?
Your Honor, we think that at a minimum, it applies to a dismissal without prejudice by either the plaintiff's own volition before there's an answer or by court order after.
So we would say that then this exception only is narrow and carved to that, and the other types of 41 dismissals don't apply here?
Your Honor, the court could frame its decision narrowly to apply to a voluntary dismissal without prejudice after the answer was filed,
but
as we have here.
Isn't that rewriting the statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Isn't that rewriting the statute?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Because the court is simply interpreting it against a background presumption. And if it were rewriting a statute, Your Honor, we couldn't have had decisions like Cannon versus University of Chicago. That statute said nothing about a private right of action, yet the Supreme Court inferred one. If the statutory interpretation methodology...
Do you think Cannon on implied rights of action is the prevailing rule for the last 34, 40 years? I thought, by and large, the Supreme Court had said, that was then, we're not going to erase what we did, but that's not what we do with implied rights of action anymore.
Right. Your Honor, that is not the most vibrant present-day example. However, that same methodology is as vital as ever, as we saw in this court's decision in Aqua Products v. Mittal, which relied on Bond versus United States, where the Supreme Court said there are certain things that go without saying. And it gave as examples in that case presumptions against extraterritoriality, presumptions against waivers of certain types of immunity. And in those situations, Your Honor...
Now I've given you three extra minutes, so we need to move on if we want to hear from the Patent Office.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I wanted to pick up on the sort of broad breadth of the presumption in the background principle, and I think it is very broad. If you look at There are many cases from many courts of appeals, including in this court, and on multiple different issues that apply this idea that the earlier suit that was dismissed without prejudice is nullified.
But there are none that are like this, where the statutory language says specifically service is what triggers the time bar, correct?
That's right. But the only exceptions that I've seen to that broader principle are when either the statute explicitly calls out dismissal without prejudice and gives it a different consequence, or where it's reopening that very case to do things like assess attorney's fees or sanctions. Other than that, the principle has been applied broadly, and the language is used.
Can you answer the question Judge Toronto asked before, where the question is whether or not the principle has been applied to nullify a triggering action for purposes of the statute of limitations as opposed to addressing a tolling of a statute of limitations?
I haven't seen anything that addresses that particular factual situation, but the point of the...
So that sort of limits the ability to say that it's such a broad, generalized proposition that it should necessarily apply here.
Well, the proposition is broad. I haven't seen it applied either way in this precise situation. But the principle that is applied in the statute of limitations context is that the earlier suit is considered ineffective, right? Ineffective to stop the statute of limitations once it has later been dismissed without prejudice. And similarly here, what we're saying is that the earlier suit is considered ineffective for purposes of this statute, which talks about service.
Can I ask, what is your answer to Judge O'Malley's question earlier about whether your principle applies only to dismissals that are both involuntary and without prejudice, or to, there are, I guess, three other possibilities, mixing prejudice, non-prejudice, involuntary, voluntary?
Well, certainly with prejudice would be a different situation, as the board decided in the LG case, but it just makes
different,
sense.
I mean, different outcome, or you...
Different outcome.
Okay, you're not just reserving it for a next...
Right, no, different outcome. In terms of whether it's voluntary or involuntary, I'm not sure of what the outcome would be. Certainly the voluntarily dismissed without prejudice category is where the case law seems to really focus. And I just don't know the answer for cases that are involuntarily dismissed without prejudice.
If we were to reach these harmless error arguments, what is the PTO's position on what we should do?
We believe a remand would be appropriate on the issue of whether the proceeding could have been brought in a different way, particularly given
not with respect to the re-exam, ex parte re-exam. You don't agree with that proposition,
right? That's right. But with respect to whether different parties could have brought different proceedings in a different way, I think
how do you deal with the statement in SAS that says there can't be anything harmless about an agency that acts outside the authority of its jurisdiction?
Well, I think in this case it would be a question of whether that, I mean, if the board were to address those issues, how it would come out. And I think the board would need to address those issues in the first instance. I don't think the PNC Bank case that the board has decided already is directly on point, since it's a CBM proceeding.
What about this Terramar case? That's an IPR.
Well, I just think that the board would need to address this particular case in the first instance.
What about the regulation 4.2? I mean 42.1.
Which
regulation that says that the question is addressed on a petition by petition basis, not a petitioner by petitioner basis.
Right, and that's something, again, I think that the board should address in the first instance. I just think that the issues haven't been fleshed out enough in this case, and the particular facts of this case may lead to a certain outcome. I just don't know, and I wouldn't want to decide that in the first instance. Or I think it would make more sense to have it remanded. And
Do you have a response to Mr. Ayer's argument about, let's call it Bonneville 1, that Bonneville 1 was a case in which the Court of Federal Claims proceeding was held to be barred by an involuntarily dismissed Board of Contract Appeals?
I'm not sure. I haven't looked at Bonneville 1.
That's how Bonneville 2 arose, when they went back to the board and said, we left you once, but we're back.
Right. But I guess I'm not sure is the answer. I haven't looked at it. And like I said before, the only exceptions that I've seen are where the statute explicitly contemplates the dismissal without prejudice. And I'm not sure what the situation was there, so I'd have to look. I wanted to also mention that the reason for Congress to rely on the judicial sort of gloss on certain words is particularly strong when the word is service, because service is something that is a creature of the courts. So it makes a lot of sense that the background principles that courts apply are what Congress intended to apply in writing the statute.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. 4 minutes for a vote.
I think the court has this well in hand. I would just want to make one remark on the remand. Obviously, this institution decision goes back to 2013. We've been up to the Supreme Court, back to this court multiple times, and I appreciate that the board hasn't ruled on these alternative grounds. But if we really believe, given that our case is being stayed pending this IPR, that the proper course is to reverse and just wipe the slate clean and allow invalidity to be tried at the district court.
What happens if you get that? Are these petitioners then defendants? Are they estopped from pressing these invalidity?
Not at all, Your Honor. Estoppel only attaches to a final written decision, and only then on a claim-by-claim basis.
But here, do we have to vacate the final written decision?
Yes, I believe you would.
But you wouldn't intend to argue that they can't ask the
Absolutely
district court
not.
To do
Absolutely
exactly
not.
What the PTAB did?
Not at all, Your Honor. We can have the same arguments based on the same prior art, and I presume that will be the prior art that's at issue in the district court. So we thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.